Hi everybody. We are gonna get started. Happy Hanukkah to those who are still in Hanukkah mode. Those of us in Eretz Israel, we just finished our Hanukkah. And as always, we have tefillot for our soldiers who are serving, for the immediate and safe return of our hostages, for the refuah shlema of all those who have been wounded and who need a refuah. And let's get started. Okay, so we are on the last of our four classes about explorers in Eretz Israel. We really spent the first three focusing on archaeologists. Okay, we talked about the earliest archaeologists, the British, the Americans. We talked about archaeology in the early state of Israel. And last time we talked, 2 weeks ago, we talked about archaeology and Tanakh. Today we're going to move away from archaeology. We're going to do a bunch of different things. This is a fun class because it's got a lot of different themes that we're going to go in different directions. And we're going to talk about how we learn the land. How did we learn the land that we've been separated from for so long? So it's less about digging, and it's more about maps and plants and drawing and seeing the landscape and understanding the landscape. Many people, both Jews and non-Jews, understood the land from far away. Right? A wonderful example is Rashi. Right? Rashi writes so much about the geography of Eretz Israel and the topography, and he really understands, even though, of course, he never was here. And yet, all of the wisdom of Rashi and Radak and all the others, it's not the same as being here and seeing, and that's what we're gonna try to explore. I brought you this picture just because I really like it. This is a map which looks like it's a very old map. It's actually not very old at all, but it's a copy. It's in the style of Crusader maps. It was painted on the walls of an abandoned building at Tzomet HaLido, at the Lido Junction. As you're coming from Jerusalem down towards the Dead Sea, and you're driving down until you can't go any further east, and you have to turn south to go down along the Dead Sea. And there's a junction there called the Lido Junction. And in the time of the British, and then when the area was under the control of the Jordanians, there was a very fancy restaurant there and people would go dancing. And today it's really an abandoned building. In 1973, there was a reserve soldier named Gershon Kochavi who was stationed there just on the border. And fortunately, he had a very boring time. Nothing much was going on. He had a lot of time on his hands. And he used that time to put a map on the walls, which is still there. It's occasionally got graffiti on it, which is terrible, and then somebody cleans it up. But it's great because if you look at it, on the one hand, it's got realism to it, right? It's got places like Hebron, right? These are places up on the hill. Hebron really is up on a hill, right? And Be'er Sheva, it has a basic understanding of north, south, east, west, but it still doesn't really, it's not really a map that you could use to navigate by, right? And we're going to see when we get to maps from ancient times, some of them are very realistic and medieval times, and some of them are very much not. So this is a nice example of something that has both, and it's actually very fun to take a look at up close. This part doesn't have it, but you can see the in other sections of it, they have Stone and Amorah with flames coming out of them, right? Like all kinds of different nice details. Okay, so this is a very basic timeline because we're really going to jump around a little bit, but always nice to have a timeline in front of us. So we're going to start in the 4th century of the Common Era with, I mean, we're not going to start with him, but the earliest we're going to look at is a bishop, a Christian named Eusebius, the Bishop of Caesarea, and the book that he writes, the geography, the Onomasticon, very important for understanding biblical geography. We're going to look at an ancient map called the Medba map from the 6th century. Now we're jumping forward to the 19th century, where we have a lot going on. As we already saw in the first class, we have all these explorers, early archaeologists who are coming here in the 19th century. We also have artists like David Roberts. We have model makers like Stephan Elis and Conrad Schick. By the late 19th century, you have enough Jews who are coming that you have a Jew named Avraham Moshe Luntz who writes A Guide to Israel for Jews who are coming to the land. We have the beginnings of photography. We're going to talk about the American colony. We're going to talk about the Armenians. We have the beginnings of botany, of really biblical botany, where Jews are trying to identify the plants that we've been separated from for so long. And we're going to get into modern times. Before that, we have, like contemporary today, but we're also going to talk about Ne'el Kidumim in the 60s and the model of Jerusalem in Second Temple times, the Holy Land model. So this is just kind of big gadol to give us a sense of time. Okay, so we're going to start out by talking about maps. Maps are very useful. They're very important. We want to have maps, first of all, to understand the text. When you learn Tanakh, it's very helpful to have a map in front of you to understand where are the tribes, where are the battles, where are the stories taking place. Although I have to say, when I was learning Tanakh in elementary school in New York, we did not use maps. But today, thank God, that has changed and much more accepted to use maps. Rashi draws, occasionally drew maps. This map here, this is a great map that on the left that was drawn by Eliyahu of Vilna, the Vilna Gaon. And as you can see, right, it's Chalukat Eretz Yisrael Lagvulot. It's the tribes, right? Where are the tribes? Where are they placed? It's a map that puts the east is on the top, right, in the style of ancient maps, even though the Vilna Gaon is in the 18th century. But ancient maps put the east on the top. Okay, we have Hayam HaGadol, the Mediterranean, over here, and we have the various tribes, right? Asher, Menashe, Ephraim, here's the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in the middle, Yehuda and Binyamin, Ever HaYarden, right? Eretz Moav. So this is very helpful for us to understand the text. We have other, you could call them maps, you could call them diagrams. For example, Maimonides, right, has a drawing of the area of the Beit HaMikdash. So you can know where is the Azara, where is the Ezrat Nashim, where are all these different places. So we have different kinds of maps like that. Now we have maps that are, for lack of a better word, imaginary, right? Or decorative. And this is a great example here. Whoever turned on their annotating, please turn it off. We don't want your scribbles. Sorry. Okay, this map here on the right is one of many maps that you can find in illuminated manuscripts, right? Very rich people in the Middle Ages would hire scribes and illustrators to make them these gorgeous pieces that they put in their, of course, hand-copied books. And this is from a book called Descriptio Terra Sancta, the Description of the Holy Land, 15th century. The artist is a French Christian. His name is Jean Milhaud. And it's great because it's partly realistic, right? Obviously, the most important thing here is Jerusalem, but you also have Beit Lechem, you have various other places. And Jerusalem is sort of realistic, right? You've got the Dome of the Rock, the great mosque in the middle, but the Dome of the Rock doesn't have this onion dome, right? You have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which does more or less look like this, but there's a lot of imaginary elements, as well. And maps were really meant to give you a sense of what did we think the land looked like, right? It's what we call today, heavenly Jerusalem, Yerushalayim Shalmala. It doesn't necessarily mean that it really looked like that. Another one that's not Jerusalem, I didn't bring it here for you, but I have a great map of the city of Jericho, right? City of Jericho, how is it described in Sefer Yehoshua? Yirichos Gura Umisugeret. It's closed and enclosed. And then we hear about the Israelites circling Yericho 7 times. So what did the artist do? He made Yericho as a city that has 7 walls around it. It's closed and enclosed, and it almost looks like a maze. Okay, so sometimes maps are real, sometimes they're imaginary, and sometimes they're somewhere in the middle. Maps can be ideological, right? The map, the one on the right is the most famous map. We'll get to that in a minute. But the ideology here is that the center of the world is the land of Israel, and particularly Jerusalem. Okay? The map on the left here, this is called the Hereford Mappa Mundi, the Hereford map of the world. It's from England, very, very Christian, actually rather anti-Semitic. You can't see any of the details here, but Jews look like the devil and all kinds of lovely things like that. But for our purposes, what's important is that the very center of the map is a cross and Jerusalem. And everything else, there are plenty of imaginary things here. There's heaven, there's hell, but everything is around. Why is my thing disappearing? Right? Everything is with Jerusalem in the center. The other map is more well known, and that's called the Bunting map. Okay. This Hereford map is from 1300. The Bunting map is later. It is from 1581. It's German. And if you've seen anything like around the city of Jerusalem, they love to show this map. It's a great map because, on the one hand, it is very ideological, right? Take a look. Jerusalem, of course, is in the center, right? Here in the center, Jerusalem. It's called the cloverleaf map also. Why does this keep erasing automatically? What am I doing here that I'm doing wrong? All right, we'll see. Okay, Jerusalem is here in the middle, and branching off from it, you have the major continents, right? Europe, Asia, Africa. Okay, and because this is in 1581, you actually have over in the corner here America, the Neue Welt. You also have all the sea monsters and all the scary things in the water. Okay. But Jerusalem is the center of the world. Now, this is an ideological map, but it's also a real map if you think about it, because really we are at the junction of all of these continents. It's not a completely made up map. By the way, these are both Christian maps. The rabbis, right? Jewish sources, Lahavdil, talk about this idea as well. They talk about Jerusalem as Tavur Ha'olam, the navel of the world, right? Or they talk about Jerusalem as if the world is an eye, then Jerusalem is the pupil in the middle of the eye, right? So you have these various ideas, and these are maps that are not meant to be used when you navigate, but are meant to teach you something. Okay, we're going to come back to maps in a few minutes, but just to go a little bit chronologically, I want to talk about Eusebius. Eusebius is a very interesting guy. He is one of the first people to try and figure out geographically where are the places of Tanakh, not just Tanakh, but the places of the New Testament as well. Eusebius is a great scholar. He's the bishop of Caesarea. He becomes the bishop in 314. And he's a contemporary of Rabbi Abahu, right? Rabbi Abahu, one of the most important of Rabbanan de Caesarea, and the rabbis of Caesarea. He appears all over the Talmud Bavli, all over the Talmud Yerushalmi. He's a very important guy. And it's clear that he engages in polemics and perhaps also in study with the Christians of his town. Caesarea is a city that has a nice sized important Jewish population, but it is by no means an only Jewish town. It has many non-Jews and a very important Christian population. And we have various kinds of polemics that Rabbi Abahu engages in against the Christians, but this is a great source here in Avodah Zarah. Now, take a look. They said to Rabbi Abahu, right? The non-Jews, the Christians said to him, "What is different about you, sages of Eretz Yisrael, that you know the Bible as well? You seem to know Tanakh so much." Rabbi Abahu said to them, "We who are situated among you, the heretics," right? He's saying we as opposed to the Babylonian rabbis. "We impose ourselves upon ourselves this obligation and analyze verses in depth, unlike the rabbis in Babel that don't have to deal with Christians," right? They're dealing with Zoroastrians. It's a different challenge. The Christians know their Bible, and they are challenging the Jews on the Bible. And that's why Rabbi Abahu says, you guys really know your Bible. We have to know our Bible too, so that we can argue with you. So that's just an interesting a connection to our sources. But what does Eusebius do? He writes this book called the Onomasticon. It's alphabetized in Greek. And for each letter, he lists the places by their book, right? If it's in Bereishit, if it's in Yehoshua, wherever. And then he tells you what he knows about it. Can we identify where this place is? So I brought you two nice examples here. Okay, one is Azeka. If you've ever gone on a tiol near Beit Shemesh, Emek Ha'ila, you've gone to Azeka. Azeka is is the place that we hear about in the story of David and Goliath. We also hear about it in the book of Yehoshua, right? And here he writes, Azeka, city of the Canaanites, to which Joshua pursued the five kings. It was given to the tribe of Judah. Okay, all that is very nice. We know that from Tanakh. But then he adds what's very important. There is now a village called Azeka between Eleutheropolis. Eleutheropolis is the Latin name for Beit Gurin, between Eleutheropolis and Jerusalem. And indeed, that is where Azekah is, between Eleutheropolis and Jerusalem. Okay, and it gives us another one. He has it under the Gamma, under the Gimel. Okay, Gebal, but really we call it Eval, as in Har Gerizim and Har Eval. Okay, a mountain in the Promised Land where Moses commanded an altar to be built. They say there are two neighboring mountains facing each other, located near Jericho. One is said to be Gerizim and the other Ebal. Now, remember that, because we're going to talk about this again with the Medvabap in a few minutes. Okay, and he's saying here that they're near Jericho. Ah, but if you've ever gone on a Tanakh tiol that takes you to Har Gerizim and Har Ebal, you don't go near Jericho, you go up to Shechem. So he brings that suggestion too. He's got more than one suggestion. The Samaritans, the Shomronim, erroneously point out two other mountains near Neapolis, right, near Shechem. But they err greatly, since the great distance of one from the other there shows they are not able to hear one another when calling out from one to hear the voices calling out, blessing or cursing, as the scripture records. We won't go into it, but in the 19th century, there was an American pastor who actually tested this out. Can you hear from Gerizim to Eval in Shechem? And it turns out you can. But Eusebius says, no, it wouldn't work. So it's really not those mountains that the Samaritans talk about. It's another set of mountains near Jericho. Okay, so sometimes we really rely on him, other times less so, but he's always very interesting. Okay. And that brings us to probably the most important, for our purposes, map in ancient times, and that's something called the Medva map or the Madaba map. In the 19th century, in a town in Jordan called Medva or Madba, in a church, there's a church called the Church of St. George, excavations were done there, and they discovered an ancient mosaic map of the land of Israel. Now, this is an amazing, amazing discovery. 6th century, meaning this is a snapshot of the land of Israel from Byzantine times. Now, as you can see, this is a drawing of the map. There are large sections that are missing, unfortunately, because not in ancient times, but in the 19th century, there were workers who were there who put pillars into the ground and destroyed pieces of the map, which is very sad. But even so, it's an amazing map. Probably the most famous part of it is the part that is the city of Jerusalem. We're going to take a look at that. But you have other pieces as well. You've got the Jordan, and you've got the Dead Sea with boats on it, which is really neat, right? You've got Eavor HaYarden. You've got, we're going to see Gerizim and Eval, not so far from Jericho, actually over here, sorry. Right, here's Jericho, the city of the palm trees. Here's Gerizim and Eval. Okay, and what this does is it shows you all of these places in the land of Israel with their Tanakh names, right, or their contemporary Greek names, but information that we really wouldn't have otherwise. Now, an interesting question is why? Why would your floor of the church have this picture, this map of the land of Israel, right? Well, what's the idea behind it? This is an awful lot of work. Why would you do this on the floor of the church? So, to first understand, you have to understand that in Byzantine times, which is the time period we're talking about here, pilgrimage to the land of Israel is a really big deal. Okay. Christians want to come. They want to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. They want to go to the churches in Jerusalem. They want to be part of the story. So you have two options when you have the map on the floor of your church. Number one, you can plan your trip. It's possible that, things are a little bit boring in church, like, by us also. And you can think about where do you want to go? This is very helpful in the days before TripAdvisor, right? And Google Maps. How do you know where things are? So this tells you where things are and you can plan out your trip. And if you're not wealthy enough to make such a trip, you can at least vicariously understand where places are. So that's really a very fascinating thing. For us, it's an amazingly helpful map. So just point out two things, right? We already talked about the part that is Jerusalem, Hagia Polis Jerusalima. This section of the map has been reproduced in lots of places. If you go in the Cardo in Jerusalem, you can see a copy of it. In the YMCA, you can see a copy of it in Jerusalem. It's a very significant map. But it actually played a role in the archaeological excavations of the Jewish quarter in post 1967. Right? Nachman Avigad, who excavated in the Jewish quarter, found finds going from First Temple times up until essentially modern times. He didn't know what he was going to find, but he did know that he was going to find the Cardo, right? And how did he know that? Because if you look at this map, it's very beautiful. Here's the Cardo. Right, a nice street with pillars on both sides running down the middle of the city. This is also an ancient map, so up is east. Okay, at the very end in the north, this is what the Arabs call Bab el Amud, right? The gate of the pillar. Here's the pillar. Okay, we call this Shaar Shechem or Damascus Gate, but we know there was a pillar here with the bust of the Emperor Hadrian on it, so he knew he was going to find the Cardo. Years later, when they did excavations at the back of the Kotel Plaza, they found the secondary Cardo, the Eastern Cardo, which we also have in here. Okay, and we have all kinds of other lovely little details like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right? All different kinds of nice things. So it's very useful and lovely for archaeologists. The other picture is of the Jordan River. Okay, and this also gives us a lot of really nice details. Okay, first of all, we have this bridge. Okay, you could see this bridge where you could ford the Jordan. Now, the Jordan was much wider in those days. We have a great story in the Gemara about Rabbi Zeira, who comes from Babylonia to cross into the land of Israel. And he sees that there's no ferry. He doesn't want to wait for the ferryman. So what does he do? He says, there's a mitzra. There's like what we would call today a zip line, right? There's poles on either side and there's a rope that's across. And he basically fords the river holding on to the rope. And he gets to the other side and somebody challenges him. Wasn't that foolish? Shouldn't you have waited? He says, I'm not going to wait. What if I don't get in? Right? But this is what that is. This is a metzra. This is this kind of an omega zip line across the bridge. So that's just a great detail. The Gemara talks about it, and here we see it in real life. Okay? Another really nice detail. We've got this plant here, which we think we'll get to this at the very end. We think this is the afarsimon plant, the balsam plant that they made perfume from. And today we're trying to figure out what that is. Okay, down at the bottom, you have the city of Jericho, the city of palm trees. I didn't have a good picture of it, but below it, you have two small mountains. One is named Gerizim and one is named Eival. They have two sets of them. They have one here near Jericho and they have one near Shechem because there were these two opinions about where these places are. Okay, so the Medva map gives us a lot of fantastic details about where things were in ancient times. So this is actually a very useful map, not an imaginary map at all. Okay, so we're gonna jump ahead in time, and we're gonna take a look at various different ways of understanding the land. Okay, and one of them is through art. Okay, probably the most famous artist of the 19th century in terms of like drawing pictures of the land of Israel, somebody named David Roberts. Again, not Jewish. Most of these 19th century guys are not. Very interesting fellow. He's a Scottish artist, He doesn't start out as a painter of landscapes or portraits. He actually starts out as a house painter. And then he becomes I don't know who you are, but please stop scribbling on the PowerPoint. I don't know if you are aware that you are doing this, but you are. Okay. Now I can't get it off. Ah, here we go. Okay. So he starts out as a house painter. Then he gets a break and he becomes a scenery painter. And he actually travels with the circus and he paints scenery for the circus and then he paints the scenery for the theaters in London. But at some point, he starts to travel abroad and he starts to paint landscapes and he becomes very well known. He becomes actually a rather famous artist. And in 1838, he decides he's going to take a trip to Egypt and various other places around the Middle East, and he comes to the land of Israel as well. And he goes home and he publishes this very popular book of travels in the Holy Land. And we have some fantastic paintings here. So this one on the left here, this is a painting of Tveria. Okay, so this is this time capsule of how things looked before they were built up. So we do have the city of Tveria. The city of Tveria already does exist. It's a very ancient city. It keeps getting destroyed and rebuilt, but it's a very, very small city. And here in the foreground, we have what today is part of the city of Tveria, but then was really on the outskirts. And you have these pillars in the water, which I'm not sure, but we know that people wrote in the 19th and 20th century, and even earlier in the 16th century, about a building that was on pillars right by the water, by the Kinneret. That was said to have the Be'er Miriam, Miriam's well, that was swallowed up in the Kinnerets. I'm not sure if that's what that is, but I'm guessing that it is. Okay. The other picture here, this was the front of the book, the frontispiece of the book. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which obviously today you would not see somebody, hanging out. I don't know what this cloth is, if it's his laundry. There are people who lived up on the roof, but you wouldn't see that. But what you do see here, which is fantastic, if you've gone to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, anyone who goes to the church, somebody points out that there's a ladder coming out of the top window. Now, this ladder is in photography from the 19th century, and it's in David Roberts's picture from 1838, and it's still there today. And this is a great example of what we call the status quo, that you can't change anything in the church. Nobody needs this ladder anymore, but it's still there. So that's in David Roberts's painting. Okay, moving from painting to building. Okay, we have models. There was a whole model making craze in the later part of the 19th century, and we have a bunch of models of various places, mostly in Jerusalem. And I'm going to show you two of them. The one on the left today, if you've gone to the Tower of David Museum, you can see it there. Right? This is a model that was made by somebody named Stefan Ilis. He was a Hungarian bookbinder who lived in Jerusalem, and he was commissioned to build this very elaborate, very intricate model of the city of Jerusalem. It took him almost 10 years to make, and when you see it in real life, you can see like all the tiny little trees and like incredibly elaborate detail. And he was commissioned to build it by the Ottomans for the World's Fair in Vienna in 1873, for the Ottoman Pavilion of the World's Fair. Now, because the Ottomans were the ones paying for it, they got to kind of dictate the terms. So what they did, first of all, the Dome of the Rock and the mosques in the Muslim quarter are way out of proportion. They're much taller than they should be proportionate to all the other buildings here. The Ottomans also wanted to show how they were so progressive. So they had Ilis put in like telegraph poles all around. But the other thing you can see about it is how little is developed outside the walls of the old city. So you've got the Tower of David over here on the west. You've got the Dome of the Rock and the Temple Mount over here on the east. Outside, really, the only things you're seeing are the area of Mishkenot Sha'ananim, okay, and Yamin Moshe in the south. You have Silwan and like very few buildings, City of David. You have Mount of Olives. It's very, very sparse outside the walls. The other thing that's really neat that you can see is if you compare this structure to how the city looks today. There's a whole bunch of towers, particularly minarets, that don't exist today. And that's because there was a big earthquake in 1927 and these were knocked down. So this is Stefan Illis's model. It has a crazy postscript to the story. They bring it to Vienna, it's in the World's Fair. Then he kind of like shops it around Europe because he wants to make some more money from it. And you can take it apart. It's made out of zinc. You can take it apart and he sends it around. He wants to see who's going to buy it. Finally, in 1878, he finds a buyer in Geneva. And it's put in a building in Geneva. It's put on display for about 20 years. And then the building is sold. It's put in a basement somewhere. It's completely forgotten about. In 1980, 100 years later, there's a student, a graduate student in Hebrew University. His name is Moti Yair, and he reads about this model. He says, "This is cool. I want to find it." And he goes to Geneva and he kind of pokes around and he manages to find it. And he gets them to lend it to the city of Jerusalem. It gets put into the Tower of David, which of course is the museum of the city of Jerusalem. And eventually, now today, it's on permanent display there, and it's just a great story. So that's the Stefan Illis model. Conrad Schick, we talked about Conrad Schick on the first class. I'm not going to talk about him too much anymore, but very interesting. Swiss German, comes as a Protestant missionary, but becomes an architect and an urban planner and an archaeologist. And he's very involved in the history of Jerusalem. And he builds all different kinds of models. And he actually does the survey that's the basis for Illis's model, but he also does models of the Temple Mount and models of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. His model of the Temple Mount is also displayed in the World's Fair. Here you have a model, a very not realistic model of what did the Beit HaMikdash look like? It looks sort of like a German townhouse. It did not look like that. But other situations, he really was very, very exacting and made things look the way they really were. Okay, so from the models of the 19th century to the most famous model of Jerusalem in the 20th century, and that's the model that was in the Holy Land Hotel. Okay, Holy Land in Hebrew, Eretz HaTzvi. Okay, Holy Land Hotel, which today no longer exists, but the model was there for a long time. Today it's been transferred to the Israel Museum. This model has a very interesting story. It's commissioned in the 1960s by the guy who builds the Holy Land Hotel. His name is Hans Kroch. He had a son named Yaakov, who was killed in the War of Independence in 1948, and he wants to make something in his memory. So he commissions a model of the city of Jerusalem at the end of Second Temple times, and he hires an archaeologist named Michael Aviona to do the research. Now, this model is made in the early 60s. It's finished in 1965. Why is that important? Because this is before the Six-Day War. We have no excavations yet in the Jewish Quarter, and not so many excavations. I mean, there are excavations that have been done in the City of David, a little bit by the Southern Wall. All of this is off limits to Jews. And so Michael Aviona is essentially working from literature. He's working from texts. Largely Josephus, not only also rabbinic texts, but largely Josephus. And he creates this model of the city. In the picture on the left, you're looking at it from the south, right? Here's the city of David. Here's the main street going up to the Temple Mount. Here's the southern wall. The picture on the right here is of the temple itself. And what's actually astounding is that after 1967, when we were able to do much more excavating, and even today, when we're still excavating in the city of David, in other places, Josephus is really very accurate. Not always. There are things we haven't found. Okay, there's this theater in the middle. We haven't found a theater in the Jewish Quarter. There was a hippodrome, a place for horse races that was eventually taken out because it clearly isn't where Josephus thought it was. Some things were changed. Okay? Robinson's Arch, we now know, is a bridge that did not go across to the Western Hill, but it went down to the street. But a lot of it is very, very accurate. And that's really just a wild thing that we have are just from texts, we can know so much about what the city looked like. Okay, moving from models to photography. Now, photography starts to become very important in the 19th century, and we're going to talk about two different groups of photographers. One is the American colony. Okay, we're going to actually talk about two different kinds of American colony, but this is the American colony of the 1880s. This is a family called the Spafford family. Horatio Spafford and his wife Anna Spafford. They had terrible, terrible troubles. She was on a cruise with their, not a cruise, she was on a transatlantic trip with their four daughters. The ship went down. She survived, but the daughters were all killed. Then they had a son who died of scarlet fever and terrible things. And they decide that they're not going to despair, but they're going to start a new Christian sect called the Overcomers. They come to Jerusalem, they do good deeds, but in order to do these good deeds, they need to make some money. So they go into the souvenir business. What does that mean? That means they take photographs and they sell them as postcards. Now you say, how do you make a living doing that? Remember that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, nobody has a camera. Okay, nobody has a phone. Nobody can take pictures. Pictures is a very valuable thing. So if you send out photographers to take nice pictures and then you sell that as a memory of the trip, everybody wants that. Everybody's going to buy that. Now, eventually they're joined by Swedes, and there's a family called the Mattson family, and they eventually take over this photography business. Now, the souvenir part is not particularly interesting to us. It helped them to survive. What's interesting to us is that these became historic artifacts. Today, the Mattson collection is in the Library of Congress. Thousands of photographs from the early 1900s, and they're just a testimony of a world that doesn't exist anymore. So take a picture over here. Take a look at the picture on the left here. This is called the Good Samaritan Inn. Anybody who has traveled out from Jerusalem out to the Dead Sea, you've passed this today. It's a museum. The building doesn't look so different. What looks different is everything around it, right? Today, what you see when you stand here is the entire huge city, 55,000 people of Maale Adumim on the hills here, okay, and the huge city of Jerusalem in the distance. Here, it's just hills. There's nothing except the building of the inn, okay? Maybe a view that's a little more familiar to most people on the right here. This is King George Street looking north. Okay, that apartment building with the rounded balconies, that's still there. But where's the Plaza Hotel? Where's Heichal Shlomo? Where's the Great Synagogue? Where's all the buildings that are to the north of Jaffa Road, right? None of that is here. So that's always, I think, fascinating to see pictures like that. Two more, okay? The Kotel on the right here. My favorite part about this picture, well, two things that are great. First of all, there's no women's section, there's no men's section. This is before 1948, before 1967, really is more accurate, where the Jews just had a very, very narrow area for the Kotel. The British didn't allow them. British bowing to pressure from the Arabs didn't allow them to do anything. And so men and women are together, no seats, no mechitza, no nothing. The other thing that's fascinating is if you look at the wall, okay, people didn't used to put notes in the Kotel. They used to write on the Kotel. They actually wrote for the refuah of, Shlomo HaKohen, for the, whatever it is that they wanted to say in a note, they set it on the stones. It's only after the Six-Day War that we scrub the stones clean and people start putting paper inside. And the other picture, I don't know if anybody can recognize it, this is a picture, a photograph of Hebron, okay, in the back here, way in the back. That's Marat HaMachpelah. Okay, this is Hebron in the 1930s. Okay, Hebron today is much, much, much more built up. This is a photograph that's taken from the south, looking north. And today, this is a neighborhood. There's a Jewish neighborhood here. This is Tal Rumeida. There's an Arab neighborhood here, Abu Snenna, and it's all built up today. In this picture, there's nothing here. So really just getting a sense of things that no longer exist. Another group of photographers, very interesting, are the Armenians. Okay? The Armenians, both in the 19th century, when they are living still relatively peacefully, mostly peacefully in the Ottoman Empire. And as a minority, they take up this new technology. Also, a lot of Armenians worked as pharmacists and as chemists. So remember, photography in those days is as much about chemistry as it is about art. So they took to this new technology. And they started to become photographers. And in the better days, they were actually commissioned by the Ottoman sultans to take photographs, to take portraits. With the Armenian genocide, those who survived needed to start anew and make a living. And photography was something that didn't have so many people doing it. And so it became something that some Armenians went into, and particularly Armenians in the land of Israel. One of the most famous of the Armenian photographers is Elia Kavejian. Elia Kavejian was a child during the genocide. His mother saved him by giving him to someone, like to get him out when everybody was being murdered. He was sold as a slave. He was a beggar. He had a horrible childhood. And eventually he was brought to an orphanage, an American orphanage in Nazareth, where he was brought up there and had, much better life. And he was apprenticed to a photographer. He was basically the guy schlepping, they had those big glass plates, and he was schlepping the plates. But he learned photography. And once he was finished with the orphanage, he went into work for an important Jewish photography concern on Jaffa Road named Hananya Brothers. And he eventually took it over. As you can see, you have Elia Photo Service, formerly Hananya Brothers. Now, most of his photography was society pictures, right? People wanted wedding pictures, they wanted family portraits, but on the weekends, he would go and he would take pictures just around the land of Israel. And those are the pictures that became the important ones. In 1948, he got advance word from the British that there were going to be riots, that things were starting, the British were going to withdraw. And he managed to take all his photo negatives and move them back into the old city, into the Armenian Quarter, where they sat in an attic for a few decades. And at some point in the 70s and the 80s, his son was cleaning out the attic. He said, "What do you want to do with these?" He says, "Throw them out." And the son said, "Well, I don't want to throw them out." And so he doesn't, and he develops them. And we have these fantastic pictures today. There's a store in the Christian Quarter in the old city, Elia Photo Service, named after the grandfather. The grandson today runs the store, and you can go and see these fantastic pictures. So I just brought you two. This is the Zeppelin, right? Graf Zeppelin over the old city of Jerusalem, 1931. This is the Damascus Gate in 1935. If you know what the Damascus Gate looks like today, where it's got these steps going down and excavations, where you see the Roman Gate. This is before all of that. Okay, moving on to a little bit about tourism. Okay, all of these new endeavors bring more people to come and see the Holy Land, and these things feed each other. The more people come to see, the more money, the more interest in photographs, in drawings, in paintings. The first real tour guide in Israel is this fellow, Rolla Floyd, the guy in the middle. He comes as part of a failed scheme by Americans to come and settle the land in the 1860s. It doesn't work out well, but he stays on along with another guy named Herbert Clark, who they both do very well for themselves. Now he stays on, and he has a very good advantage because he brought with him, these guys came from Maine. He brought with him a wagon, okay, from Maine, a Maine spring wagon, which it seems was better than any of the other wagons that were available in the land of Israel. And he starts a service ferrying people from Jaffa to Jerusalem. And he gets like an exclusive contract to bring people up to Jerusalem, and he learns about the land, and he becomes not just a driver, but a guide. And he does something else. He hooks up with the premier travel agency of the time, which is called Cook's, which happens to be run by his buddy from the American colony, right, Herbert Clark. So it's a nice little business that he has going there, and he becomes very wealthy, and he does very well for himself, and he is the guide for VIPs. So when Ulysses S. Grant comes to visit the land of Israel, who takes him around? Rolla Floyd. Right, so he's very interesting for tour guides because he is really the very first one. Okay, but let's talk a little about Jews. Okay. Avraham Moshe Luntz, one of the most unusual researchers in the land of Israel, not only because he is a person who just knows a lot, he knows a lot of Torah. He puts out a critical edition of the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is not an easy thing to do. He writes guidebooks to the land of Israel. You can see this picture on the left here, Yericho, Ir HaTamarim, and he writes about what it is today. This is towards the end of the 19th century. He puts out almanacs, Luach Shana, Luach Eretz Yisrael, which tell you useful things like what day is market day in various places, right? Market day in Shechem is on Fridays. Market day in Yericho is, right? Very helpful things. He even gives you useful phrases that you might want to know, right? Before Google Translate, right? So he says, he's got all these different phrases from Hebrew to Arabic. So if you want to say, Ken Adoni, yes, sir, you say, Naam Yasidi. Right? If you want to say how much, you say bakas. Right? If you want to say ve'efotishkam, where are you going to stay? Finachasaken. You have your little phrase book. It's very useful. But that's not what makes him extraordinary. What makes him extraordinary is that in 1879, he goes blind. Okay? He's still a young man, relatively young man, and he becomes blind. And it's very tragic, but he says, I'm going to continue researching the land of Israel. And he writes in one of his books, he says, Iver hineni ka'et, I've become blind right now. Ulam ach enei b'sari kamu mirod. My physical, my eyes of flesh and blood can no longer see. But od avod avodati kevarishonav, I'm going to keep up my work Al Hare Israel, right? Traveling around on the hills of Israel. So he is determined that he is going to keep on studying the land even when he can no longer see. So he's really an extraordinary person. Okay, we're going to move, jumping around a little bit in chronology, but we want to talk a little about flora and fauna. So this guy, Ernst Schmidt, the guy in the middle here, he is a Catholic priest. He actually comes to Jerusalem to run the Dominican school, Schmidt College in Jerusalem. But he also has a hobby, and his hobby is animals. Now, when animals are your hobby in the 19th century, it doesn't necessarily mean you have pets. What it means is you go out and you shoot animals, and that's what he did, which is on the one hand horrible, but on the other hand, he preserved species who would have been shot by other people anyway. He shot them and he taxidermied them, okay? And he made this incredible collection of the animals of the land of Israel, who no longer exist in the land of Israel, right? Alligators and leopards and various kinds of animals that are no longer around. He created this collection, which, like the Illis model, got lost at some point and nobody knew where it was. And eventually it was rediscovered again in the 1980s by a researcher for the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel, Yossi Leshem. And he found this collection. And he asked, it was in very bad condition, and he asked the fathers of the Dominican fathers, can not the Dominican, sorry, the German fathers, Catholic fathers, can he have it so that he can restore it, and can he borrow it? And it's been restored, and today it's in the really beautiful new Natural History Museum in Tel Aviv, and it's really the first natural history collection in the land of Israel. So that's a very cool thing. All right, we'll talk a little about botanists. Okay, one of the first real botanists in Eretz Yisrael is someone named Aaron Aronson. If his name sounds familiar, that is because he was also, besides being a botanist who discovered the original strain, the ancestor of all wheat, and he discovered the emmer wheat, but he also was the founder of a spy group called Nili. And these guys spied on the Ottomans on behalf of the British during World War I. The most famous member of the spy ring is Sarah Aronson, who was caught but who refused to give up any of the names of her fellow spies, and she eventually commits suicide rather than tell anybody's names. That's her grave over there on the right. Aaron Aronson is the founder of the spy ring, but he's also very involved in botany in the land of Israel. And when there's a terrible locust plague in 1915, he is involved in figuring out how to get rid of the locusts, and very, very interesting fellow who would be famous even if he wasn't involved in the spy ring. Botany and Torah, right? We want to know the plants of the land of Israel. We want to know the plants of the Tanakh. We want to know the plants of the Mishnah. One of the first people to write about this was a Hungarian rabbi named Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Lo. He never came to the land of Israel, but he researched and he wrote one of the first books about the flora of the land of Israel. A later, not really a contemporary, they overlap a little bit, but a later teacher is someone named Yehuda Felix, who's really considered kind of the father of botany of Tanakh and botany of the Mishnah. He studied biology and Talmud at the Hebrew University, and he wrote works that identify the animals and the plants of the land of Israel that are written about in the Tanakh and in the Mishnah. Other real pioneers are the Haruvenis, Ephraim and Chana Haruveni. They took an interdisciplinary approach to, they study languages, they study Torah texts, they study botany. They start a collection first in their home. Eventually, they move it to the university on Mount Scopus. In 1926, they have a collection of all different plants of the land of Israel. The plan is to create a what they call Gan HaNevi'im v'Chachmei HaTalmud, right? A garden of the prophets and the scholars of the Talmud. Now, they don't get to do this mostly because in 1948, Mount Scopus, of course, becomes surrounded by enemy territory. The Hebrew University has to move. They have to move their collection. They don't finish this, complete this vision, but their son does, and we'll get to him in a little bit. But before we get to him, working with the Haruvenis is this guy, Shmuel Haruvi. Shmuel, his original name was Shmuel Boxer. If you understand a little Hebrew and Yiddish, you'll get that. You'll get that. Meaning, right? Boxer is the Yiddish word for carob. Charuv is the Hebrew word for carob. So when he came to Israel, he Hebraicized his name. And he is hired by the Reuvenis to draw these incredibly beautiful plants. They make an encyclopedia of plants of the land of Israel with all these botanical drawings. And you have over here on the top, on the left, you have capers. Okay, you have the marva or the Moriah plant, which you could see looks like a menorah. Okay, you have down here the cyclamen, the rakefet. These drawings were actually also forgotten about till the 2000s, and then they were kind of rediscovered, and the Israel Museum put on an exhibit of his drawings and published a beautiful book of them, and they're really gorgeous. Okay, another pioneering plant person is Alexander Eig. Alexander Eig comes to Israel from Minsk when he's 14 years old. He also very involved in like this pioneering botany. He makes the first map of where plants grow, phytogeography, okay, where the different plants grow, and he creates the first what's the word I want? Magdir Tzmachim, right? Like a plant dictionary, not this one, an earlier one. But he's perhaps better remembered for creating the first botanical gardens. Okay? Also, on Mount Scopus, is going to be the epicenter of all these things. 1948, it's beautiful botanical gardens. It becomes very neglected because there's just soldiers up on Mount Scopus. A different botanical garden is made in the west side of the city. But after 67, actually only in the like 90s, is the botanical garden on Hebrew University on Mount Scopus is redone. And today it's really a beautiful place. Okay, we're getting to our last people in our last few minutes. Okay, Ze'ev Vilnai. Ze'ev Vilnai is of the generation of the Palmach. He's a military topographer. Okay, what that means is he studies the land and he tells the soldiers what's a good place to go, right? We're going to talk about Jabot at the very end. He does the same thing. After he finishes in the army, he writes books about the land of Israel. He writes an encyclopedia. He writes an encyclopedia of Jerusalem. He encourages hiking. He writes a book about its educational value. This is a picture of a tiol that he took to the Shomron in 1927. He's on the Va'adat Shemot, the official naming committee of the State of Israel. The idea being to give names that are connected to historical references, to Tanakh, to all sorts of other things. Kind of a strange little story, but a fun story. He finds this boat. This is a boat that was taken by a French guy named, a British guy named Thomas Molyneux. He wanted to explore the Dead Sea in the 19th century. He actually gets sick and dies. The boat goes back to England. Vilna'i reads about this. He's fascinated. He goes, he finds it, he brings it back to the land of Israel. Nogar Reuveni, the son of Ephraim and Chana, he fulfills their vision and he creates this beautiful park of Ne'ot Kidumim, which is the plants of Tanakh and of the Mishnah and really brings it alive. But he also writes an amazing book called Or Chadash al Yirmiyahu, A New Light on the Book of Jeremiah, where he's really the first one. Today everybody does this, but he's the first one in the 1950s who says Yirmiyahu doesn't live in a vacuum. Tanakh is not written in a vacuum. He lives in the land. And when he writes certain things, it's because they are connected to the land. So he picks up on certain elements in the book. For example, the fact that Yirmiyahu is the only Navi really who talks about waking up early and talking, hashkem v'daber, or he talks about walking and going, haloch va'amadita. Why? Because he lives in Anatot. Anatot is about a 2-hour walk to get to the old city. And he has to wake up early in order to get to the old city and in order to speak to the people. He doesn't live in Jerusalem. Hey, Nogar Reuveni understood where Anatot was in relation to the city. Hey, he also understood that it was above Jerusalem. And that's why he says Jerusalem is called Yoshevet HaEmek, sitting in the valley. And other scholars said, what do you mean valley? It's not in the valley, it's on a mountain. He says, yeah, but if you're coming from Anatot, you're coming from the mountains. You're looking down Jerusalem. It really is in the valley. Okay, I want to get to Jabot, so we're going to go very quickly. All right, let's do a Zohar Amar is great. All right, Zohar Amar is one of the new generation of people looking at the text and also looking at the world. And he studied everything ranging from what kind of plants does the Mishnah talk about when it talks about maror, bitter herbs, to what are the traditions about kosher animals that people don't anymore, for example, locusts, to helping to replant the plants that the spices of the incense came from, like the afarsamon, like the balsam, and many, 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 many more things. The Safrai families, Shmuel Safrai and his children, Ze'ev Safrai and Yibadel Chaim and Chana Safrai, who Alea Shalom, they worked to create something called Mishnat Eretz Yisrael, which is taking the Mishnah and looking at examples in the real world, right? Understanding what did the money look like, understanding how many people came to the Beit HaMikdash on Aliyah LaRegel, understanding what did people's clothes look like. It's an amazing resource. Hey, this is a plug for the next series we're going to have starting next week, which is part two of the flashback series of looking at the realia of the Gemara. So much of that is from Mishnat Eretz Yisrael. And finally, the person we started this whole series because of, Shavo Erlich, tragically killed in Lebanon very recently, about a month and a half ago. Amazing, amazing researcher of the land, wrote many books, traveled all over, was the head of the field school in Ofrat. This is one of his books about Ephraim, the area of Ephraim and Binyamin and Menashe, basically about the Shomron. Advised the army on many, many things because he really knew the land. And I just wanted to bring you a couple of examples. Okay, he talks about Rahav in Sefer Yehoshua, right? Rahav who hides the spies, and she hides them in the flax on her roof. And he talks all about flax, about Pishtan, and how she clearly is somebody who has a Pishtan industry. She has this flax drying on her roof. That's where she hides the spies. She lowers them with a rope which was made out of flax. She hangs a red string in her window to save herself. All of this comes from the flax, which makes linen. He connects all those pieces. Okay? He talks about when the waters of the Jordan stop, right? When the people of Israel cross with Yoshua, and it says the waters stop, and we have this pasuk that says they came down in a great heap and they piled up at Adam, right? They cross near Jericho over here. Why is the pasuk talking about Adam, 30 kilometers to the north? As he says, this is where the river is very close to the mountains. Sometimes there's an earthquake, like there was in 1927. You could see over here. Stones from the mountain fall into the mouth of the river and stop the water 30 kilometers down. So he says, yes, it's a miracle because of the timing. It's not a miracle like at Kriyat Yam Suf, at the splitting of the sea. It's a miracle because a miracle is nature plus timing. It's a great example. And he also talks about Ein Prat, where Yirmiyahu hides his loincloth. And he talks about it as a place of living waters. We are out of time and we have a few questions. So I'm going to stop here and take a look at people's comments for a minute. The Library of Congress has the Library of Congress has this collection. It's amazing. You can see a lot of these pictures. It's a very, very cool thing. Thank you for providing the link. If anybody wants to copy it, right? The American Colony Pictures. On King George, the building with the round porches is, it's like a block up from where the plaza is. I don't have a better cross street. I think it's by Hama'alot. I don't remember exactly. Before you get to like the commercial part. I don't know anything about if Alexander Ike, probably, they're all from Minsk. You know, it goes back to Har Sinai. I do not think the Reuvenis are related to the Reuveni of the nursery, but perhaps they had two children. They had Noga and they had Ayelet HaShachar. Could be, I don't think so. Niagara Falls are one stop by an ice floe. Nice connection. Okay, thank you everybody. We will be starting a new series next week. Like I said, part two of our like going back in time and looking at the realia of the Mishnah and the Gemara. Shabbat Shalom, happy
Thank
post-Hanukkah,
you.
Chodesh Tov, and everybody should have good news. Besorot
Amen.
Tovot.
You too,
Thank
Shuli.
you.
Thank you,
Thank
Shuli.
you. Thank
Thank
you.
you very
I
much.
do. I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shuli.
Thank you.